So I'm Tierra Curry, and I'm a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, and I lead our Extinction Crisis Campaign, which is called Saving Life on Earth, and I also co-direct our Endangered Species Program.
Now, Tierra, are there websites for Saving Life on Earth?
Yes, you can go to savelifeonearth.org, and it will take you to our Extinction Crisis page at the Center for Biological Diversity's main website. It's easy to remember, savelifeonearth.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, I'm interested in saving all species from extinction, even the unpopular species like crayfish and caddisflies and freshwater mussels, but also, you know, the big species that people really relate to, like giraffes and elephants and beautiful things like monarch butterflies. And so the Center for Biological Diversity, where I've been a biologist for the last 17 years, I chose this organization because they draw the line at extinction, no matter what the species is. And I think that every species has the right to be here. So that resonated with me as a core value, that we're on this planet with at least 8 million other amazing organisms, and we need to make space for them because they have as much of a right to be here as we do. So that's why I've done this work for so long, and I'm a biologist, but unfortunately I spend a lot of time in the policy realm just trying to gain greater protections for endangered species and their habitat.
I think you must have a hierarchy of animals, plants, insects that you think should be saved. I think perhaps the skunk and the mosquito are down a little bit on that hierarchical table.
I gotta ask you, have you seen the videos of the skunks doing handstands in the desert? They are so cute.
No, Google I haven't.
Skunks doing handstands, and you'll change your tune on them. Yeah, so when I started running our Extinction Crisis campaign, my boss actually sat me down and said, Tierra, you're going to have to talk about more than crayfish and freshwater mussels. You're going to have to talk about polar bears and other big animals that other people care more about. So that was really funny to me because a lot of our members, we have great members, a lot of them come to us because of wolves. And then we nudge them in the direction of spring snails and the like. My personal hierarchy is the line of extinction. When there is a species and something is going to disrupt its habitat so much that that entire species is going to go extinct, then I pretty much drop everything I'm doing to try to get protections in place for it, no matter what kind of plant or animal it is. And a lot of my colleagues share that core value, so that's how we make decisions first, is this project going to cause an entire species to become extinct? And if it is, we're going to intervene on its behalf.
Occasionally, there'll be a news story about an extinct species that reappears somewhere on the globe. And
yes.
I have called a number of specialists like yourself, and invariably they hang up the phone when I tell them I've discovered not just the mermaid in the backyard, because we live on a river, but also the T-Rex.
I love T-Rex. I would love to come meet your T-Rex. T-Rex jokes are one of my favorite things in the whole world. I have this shirt with a T-Rex, and it says, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, if anybody's listening and they want to send me T-Rex jokes, I appreciate them more than most people, I would suspect.
Okay, so you have the hierarchical interest. You drop everything when there is a crisis. And what are two or three of the major crises that you're focused on now?
One example of that is there was a freshwater crayfish in West Virginia called the Guyandot River crayfish. And coal mining had wiped it out of its entire range except for two creeks. And there were hundreds of proposed coal mines on these two creeks. So we assembled a team and started filing comments and lawsuits and challenges and pressuring the Fish and Wildlife Service to give it greater protections and to protect its critical habitat. So the good news is it's still on the planet. The bad news is we're still fighting hundreds of mines in its habitat. But that's just an example of an activity that was going to drive an entire species off the planet. One of my colleagues out in Nevada ends up in this situation a lot because in the desert, the freshwater species that survive there are isolated from each other. And now there's just a whole flurry of energy projects and mining projects in the desert, and it seems like so many of them would wipe out an entire species. So I don't envy his job of having to protect literally his docket has grown to hundreds of species that are at extinction's door if we can't get better sites for some of the projects that they're proposing.
One of my podcast episodes is a conversation with a biologist, and his primary job is going to construction sites before they get underway, looking for endangered species, and then also putting up barriers to keep poisonous snakes and whatever out of the construction zone, and finally teaching the construction workers what to look for and what to do and what not to do.
That's so important, because wildlife needs so much help, and so just by intervening and showing people where they are and how to protect them, we could save so many more animals from harm's way if everyone took the time to do those sorts of activities. So that's one of my primary career goals, is just to get people passionate about saving wildlife, but also empowered to do something about it. Because most people agree that we're in an extinction crisis and we're losing wildlife habitat every day, but a lot of people don't feel like there's anything that they can do about it in a meaningful way. And there are literally thousands of things that people can do and ways to get involved.
You mentioned just a few minutes ago that there are people that are members of the organization, the Biological Diversity. How do people become? How would I become a member of the organization?
You would just go to our website or call us up or write us and make a donation. We ask for $35 a year. A lot of our members give greater amounts than that. And one of the things that's unique about our organization is a lot of our budget comes from membership dues. And a lot of those are small donations from people all around who care about, you know, making space for endangered species on the planet. And like, a lot of people aren't in a place in their life where they have time or capacity to get involved in the on-the-ground battles or the policy battles, but they do have capacity to make a donation. And so those donations fuel our work and help us stand up for the monarch butterflies and the crayfish and the giraffes and polar bears.
I hope that the listeners will run right to that website and take action. Simple action for such an important activity.
Yeah, there's no shortage of species that need help, and so we make the best use of all of our donation dollars to try to get involved in as many different campaigns as we can.
You've probably been to a site where the extinction is months, moments away, where it's so amazing if you can literally find like the crawdad in the creek. And of course, a lot of folks are persnickety. They're going to insist on crick.
It's like, even crawdad, there's actually a map of how people say crayfish around the country. And so by region, it's crayfish, crawfish, crawdad, crawdaddy, mudbug, craycraw. It's really interesting, the different names that people give to different animals around the country.
Yeah, again, on the mermaid thing. It looks like a mermaid, but I've been told it's just a big carp. Beauty's in the eyes of the beholder. Okay, so, any more to say about the organization?
I would like to go back to the point you just made, that I've been in habitats where species are on the brink of extinction, and I have been in those habitats, but one of my favorite species to see is still the monarch butterfly. I'm in Kentucky, and last April, I actually got one of the migrating monarchs that overwintered in Mexico came to my yard, the super generation, and laid eggs. And so I'm out in the yard every day looking for any sign of a monarch butterfly, because their population is so low this year. It's the second lowest population level ever recorded. That I'm not very hopeful that I'm going to get to see very many. So every single one that I see, I'm gonna count as a miracle and ask it if it wants to come inside and have a drink and a rest, you know.
Let's get right to the monarch. I think it's an insect. It has, what, 8 legs?
Mm-hmm.
A thorax and an abdomen. That's about all I know about that monarch. But it starts out as a nymph. And where does the nymph get generated, get born?
Yeah, so monarchs are they're the big, beautiful, graceful orange and black butterflies. I think their wings look like stained glass windows. Their wings are orange with heavy black veins, and then on the outer edges, there's two rows of white polka dots against the black. And there are different butterflies, like queen butterflies and viceroy butterflies, who look similar to them, but they're the biggest and most graceful. And they only lay their eggs on milkweed. And there's hundreds of different kinds of milkweed. Some of the most common kinds are common milkweed and pink milkweed and butterfly milkweed, which is orange. And the adults aren't picky about which kind, as long as it's one of the native kinds and not tropical milkweed, which causes a whole suite of its own problems. But the females lay their eggs on the milkweed plants, and then in a couple days, the eggs become tiny caterpillars. And those caterpillars eat so much milkweed, and they go through several molts and grow into a pretty familiar caterpillar for a lot of people. It's black and white and yellow striped. And then the caterpillar forms a chrysalis, which is really cool. It's like an enclosure where the developing butterfly hangs down from a surface, and it has these beautiful gold dots on it. It's a bright mint green with a row of gold dots on the bottom. And inside that chrysalis, the caterpillar basically dissolves into something called butterfly soup, which is amazing. Every cell in that soup has something called an imaginal disc and can become any body part of the butterfly. So it's like the perfect metaphor for potential and change and metamorphosis. And then in a couple weeks, the butterfly closes and metamorphoses. And if it's summer, it'll fly north looking for more milkweed. And if it's fall, then they will fly to the mountains of Mexico to overwinter. So it's a multi-generational migration. It's one of the longest insect migrations. Some monarchs fly from Canada to Mexico from 2,000 to 3,000 miles. And it's just such a special and beautiful species because of its life history and because of it used to be so abundant. There used to be about 1 billion monarchs there in all 48 contiguous states. And so now the population has declined by more than 90%, and it's 1/6 of the size that scientists estimate that it needs to be at for the migration to be able to continue. So later this year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is slated to list monarchs as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act.
How does the monarch determine when it's transitioning from summer to winter? Is it a temperature, or is it the movement of the earth relative to the sun? Any idea what's triggering that?
It's all of those things, and that's one reason they're so threatened now, is because climate change is messing up all of those cues. And so when it gets colder, the milkweed stops flowering, and when there's no more milkweed, they fly south in search of warmer temperatures. The days are getting shorter, they follow the angle of the light. And the problem is that as it stays warmer longer in the fall, the milkweed stays in bloom and the monarch doesn't get the cues that it needs to migrate. And then we get a cold snap and they freeze to death and die because they haven't made it back to the suitable habitat for the winter.
Has that been an observation that science has had for a decade or longer?
So I've seen it here. I moved to Kentucky from Oregon in 2020, and I had monarch caterpillars in my yard in Kentucky in November. And in November, every eastern monarch should already have been at the party in Mexico. They arrive back to the mountains of Mexico, usually for Day of the Dead celebrations, at the beginning of November. And so I knew that those monarchs were not going to make it through the winter, that the caterpillars weren't going to survive. And I had to make the existential choice. What do? Do I bring them inside and let them metamorphose and try to overwinter a butterfly on orange slices? Or do I just let nature take its course? And so in 2020, I let nature take its course. And then 2 years ago, I had a chrysalis hanging on my porch, and it was going to freeze that night, but I knew it would be warmer after that, and I still had flowers in my yard, so I actually did bring that chrysalis inside and hang it in a window, and that monarch metamorphosed, and I let it go, and I knew that this was November as well. I knew it probably wouldn't make it to Mexico, but I just hoped that it would have a couple good days as a butterfly out eating flowers and enjoying the sunshine.
That's a tender story. Thanks for sharing it.
I think so many people have stories like that because monarchs are so common and they were such an important part of so many people's childhoods, and watching the migration or learning about metamorphosis. It's the classic butterfly that people study to learn about metamorphosis. And so they're really like a true part of Americana and of childhood summers. And for something like that, that used to be so common and abundant, to now be a threatened species is really an indicator of how much we have mucked up the climate, how much pesticides we've used, how much land use change we've brought about that's driven the decline of common insects like the monarch and the American bumblebee and the rusty patch bumblebee and so many other pollinators that are facing extinction now.
Does the viceroy and the other butterfly you mentioned compete for the food that the monarch also uses?
Most butterflies have a specific host plant for their caterpillars. The females lay their eggs on a specific plant, like the zebra swallowtail butterfly uses pawpaw. The pawpaw tree is a host plant, and a lot of them have those relationships. Adult butterflies nectar on hundreds of different flowers, including monarchs. And so one of the ways that people can help monarchs is by having flowers blooming in their yard or balcony from early spring all the way through late fall, so that the butterflies get the nourishment they need to either survive the winter up here in the cold climates or fly south where they're going for the winter.
When I see monarch up here in Wisconsin, I generally see them in late summer, early fall, and maybe a dozen or two, a few minutes, 10, 15 minutes. And they seem to be just kind of flying, not erratically, and I think they're actually hunting, looking for perhaps the color of a plant.
It would be an olfactory cue. They would be chasing down the scent.
In a breeze, they probably can't pick up the smell of a plant very well, but if it's a quiet air, can they smell it 10, 15 feet away?
Oh, yeah, and the female monarchs can hone in on milkweed from, we're not even sure how far away. They just kind of soar over the landscape looking for the chemical signature of milkweed plants. So the viceroy that you just asked about, that's actually the state butterfly of Kentucky. They look like monarchs, but they're smaller, and they have a black band across their wing, in a straight curved line that monarchs don't have. And their host plant is willows, so any kind of willow leaves will be food for their caterpillars.
Is that butterfly on the extinct list?
No. And I hope you mean the endangered list. There are, unfortunately, yes, a handful of butterflies that have gone extinct, unfortunately. Like the Xerces blue butterfly. Now there's a conservation organization called the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, and they're named after the extinct Xerces blue from California. A handful of butterflies in Florida have now gone extinct, and it's a group that needs a lot more attention and funding that it gets. And I get criticized sometimes for always promoting the monarch because people think the monarch gets funding that other pollinators should get. But the reality is that the smaller, endemic, less popular pollinators wouldn't get that funding anyway. And so by creating safe spaces for the monarch, we're creating umbrella habitats that help all of the other pollinator species as well.
Before we leave the egg and get to the chrysalis, How long a period is that? Is that a week, 2 weeks?
So it's temperature dependent. In summer and warm temperatures, the egg will probably hatch in 2 or 3 days. And the beginning caterpillars, they're so tiny. They're tinier than the tip of my pinky nail. And they grow so fast. Like within 2 weeks, you go from just a tiny caterpillar to the full grown ones are about the size of your thumb.
When I see the milkweed and I know the monarch is developing, it always looks like there are black aphids around. Is that an insect or is that the excrement?
Monarch caterpillars have a lot of excrement and they like to hang upside down, so I usually see their droppings before I actually find the caterpillars. And it's usually very visible green lumps because they're just eating the milkweed leaves and passing them pretty much straight through. But the aphids or the other things you are seeing could be feeding on their excrement, and also lots of things feed on the caterpillars themselves and on the butterflies. And that's another reason why they're so important, because they were once so abundant, they're going to play a significant role in pollination because they're so widespread and the adults nectar on so many different flowers. And also because so many things eat butterfly eggs and butterfly caterpillars. One of the classic studies about monarchs is about the toxicity of the caterpillars and the butterflies, and that's why they eat milkweed. Milkweed has a chemical in it that is toxic to a lot of other animals, and it can make birds throw up. And so birds, where the monarchs gather in the sanctuaries in Mexico for the winter, there are migratory songbirds who go there to eat the monarchs, and they will just rip individual monarchs into pieces to taste test which ones taste bitter and which ones don't, and they'll eat the ones that have the lower doses of the chemical from the milkweed.
I had thought that the viceroy was more tasty for the bird, but apparently it isn't.
It is, because the poison comes from the milkweed, and so the viceroy mimics the monarch so that birds will just see the orange and be like, oh, I don't want to eat that one, because they don't have that same chemical defense.
Okay, now the migration of the animal there, do we start with the story then up north and the migration to the south, or does the story begin in the south with eventually the migration up to the north?
We can start in the north because that's the super generation of monarchs. So the last generation of summer is called the super generation. They're usually up where you are, up by the Great Lakes and in southern Canada. Those monarchs are going to fly all the way to Mexico, live through the winter, and then fly north again in the spring to Texas and the Gulf Coast. And one made it to Kentucky last spring that I saw. They're going to lay their eggs and then they're going to die, having lived for many months. When those eggs hatch and become butterflies, they only live for a few weeks. Those summer generation monarchs each live as adults for a few weeks, and they fly north chasing the milkweed until the end of summer when the next super generation is born.
Okay, the straight line. The butterflies that are here on the Great Lakes in my backyard, they probably started maybe a few hundred miles north of Wisconsin?
Well, so you're probably going to get them coming and going. So you'll have ones that were born a couple hundred miles south of Wisconsin, and then you could have super generation ones, or you could have ones stopping by from Canada on their way south again. It would just depend on the time of year.
In the late summer, very, very early fall, temperatures are just starting to get into the upper 40s. Can we predict what population of the butterfly in my backyard at that time?
You would need to look at your milkweed. If you've still got flowering milkweed, you could still have breeding monarchs, because the milkweed is what gives the adults the cue to continue in reproductive status. If there's no more milkweed, they go into what's called reproductive diapause and head south again. And so I mentioned tropical milkweed earlier. That's a problem because it's not native to the U.S. and it doesn't die back in warmer areas. And so the migrating monarchs get back down to Texas, Arizona, Southern California, the Gulf Coast. They see the tropical milkweed and they stay put. They don't migrate. And those populations aren't as healthy. They're more prone to disease. Like, migrating is good for them because it lowers the disease load, and the conditions are generally right for them to survive the winter in their migratory grounds. So tropical milkweed is popular because it's pretty, it's red and yellow, and it's really easy to grow, and you can buy it online, but it should definitely be avoided.
Okay, so the butterfly leaves my backyard, and it's on its way to Mexico. Does this butterfly die off somewhere, and does a second generation pick up?
No, that butterfly will make friends, and they will hang out together in trees. It's really pretty when you find a monarch roost, because as they fly south and group up, you can find trees covered in hundreds, if not thousands, of monarchs, just waiting for the weather conditions to be right, and then they kind of funnel along a similar pathway through Texas. Till they get to Mexico, they overwinter and then fly north. And then the summer generations are the ones who only live a few weeks.
Does the monarch have a way to catch a jet stream?
That's another problem with climate change, because the frequency and intensity of severe storm events has increased, especially hurricanes and also now forest fires. And so they're just doing the best they can, trying to make their way back to Mexico. They have to cross thousands of roads. They could get hit by cars. And now with the weather just being all over the map in terms of hot, cold, storms, fires, droughts, freezes, all kinds of unseasonal things, it's just become really, really tough and less predictable for them to survive the southward and the northward migration.
Well, the butterfly seems to be a pretty strong flyer. I've seen them hold their position and get to the milkweed in pretty good gusts of wind.
They are strong flyers. They are tough. I've seen photos of monarchs missing most of both of their wings who somehow survived the migration and made it north again to lay their eggs. But the problem is they have to put on enough weight while they're still flowers to make it to Mexico and survive in the winter. They overwinter in these high elevation Oyamel fir forest above 10,000 feet where it's cool. And the reason they go there is because it's cool enough, they just hang out and don't burn off their body fat. So the more that they have to fight the wind, the longer their migration gets delayed, the more weight they're going to lose, and they might not have enough lipid stores to survive the winter and fly north again, because there aren't necessarily going to be flowers for them to feed on during winter.
The last guest on the podcast was speaking about the cicada and the cicada strategy of just having huge populations, like in an acre, maybe a million cicadas come up. And the cicada apparently survives because there are so many. Eventually the birds and the squirrels and the chipmunks are tired of eating the cicada. And, you know, there's enough of the cicadas that they just move on and live a life and regenerate. With the monarch in this area, 10,000 feet in Mexico, what's the predator that restful insect has? Is it, I know you mentioned certain birds.
Yeah, that's another reason why it's so important for there to be so many monarchs so they can survive that predation threat. There are birds who eat them specifically. There are also mammals on the forest floor who feed on them. So if the temperature drops, the monarchs, they don't really produce body heat on their own, so they're just stuck on the forest floor until the sun comes out. And so it's estimated that small forest mammals eat 5% of the overwintering monarch population every winter.
Have you been down to Mexico to see the animals, the insects, before they, or when they actually start their flights back up north?
I have. I went. So scientists say we need 6 hectares, or about 225 million monarchs in Mexico, for the migration to be okay. And since I've been advocating for monarchs since 2014, the population has only been at that level once. And so the year where everything went right that could, according to weather, there were so many monarchs, and I went that year to see them. And I was scared then that would be the last great year, and unfortunately so far that's played out. The population this year is a sixth of the size that it was then.
In 2014, with that population, does that population of butterflies produce any kind of noise with their wings in that huge, huge population?
It's so cool. It sounds like a stream, or like it kind of looks like leaves flying around. If it's cloudy, then they're all just clustered on the trees. But when the sun comes out, they take flight, and all of the wings, it just sounds like a stream running. It's the most beautiful thing. So 2014 was a very low year. That was actually the lowest population ever recorded. I think it was probably 2017 or 2018 when the population was high again. And that.
Thank you. Now, there's an eastern monarch population and apparently a western, and the Mississippi River is generally the dividing line?
The Rocky Mountains is the dividing line.
Okay. So the butterflies that are all accumulating in Mexico, they eventually, as they fly north, make a split, and some of them head to the Pacific?
So there is, It's not a hard line because there's overlap between the populations. In general, monarchs east of the Rockies overwinter in Mexico, and monarchs west of the Rockies actually overwinter on the coast of California in evergreen trees on the coast, where the climate is also cool. But some monarchs from Arizona and from California can go to either California or to Mexico for the winter. And so there's genetic intermixing, so they're the same species. Also, the western population is a tenth of the size or less than the eastern population. Like 99% of the population is the eastern population that goes to Mexico.
The western group, are they in as much
They stress? Are, unfortunately, and it's similar reasons, but also as the climate in California gets warm, they are abandoning their traditional migratory behavior, and people trying to help them and planting tropical milkweed in their yard are disrupting the migration further. And so I was in Los Angeles a few winters ago, and I saw monarchs in winter in the Trader Joe's parking lot because there was a bunch of tropical milkweed there. And so though it's not as safe for them not to migrate, and especially to stay in urban areas. And so the California migratory winter monarch population a few years ago was down to 2,000 butterflies. And that's largely because the weather wasn't stable and they were just hanging out in people's yards. And we were all afraid that that was it, that the Western migration had collapsed. But then they rebounded to a couple hundred thousand butterflies, but then the severe winter storms that have battered California have killed off around a third of that population again. So the climate change impacts in California are dire. And also there's still logging of monarch winter trees in California. They're not, until they get Endangered Species Act protection, the trees where they overwinter aren't protected.
Pick up a really, really strong wind, and you get recordings of them in the Canary Islands or in the Bahamas, you know, places that are over the ocean that you just wouldn't expect the monarch to be found.
Oh yeah, monarchs get blown off course, like a lot of things, but also because they're so pretty, people have just taken them everywhere. So there's monarch populations in more than 30 countries now. But none of them are as cool as ours, because ours are the ones with the multi-generational 2,000-mile migration.
We understand the life cycle from the little egg up to the chrysalis, up to the adult, eventually getting to Mexico. We've talked about monarch poop.
Let's talk. There's a word for it. It's called fress or frass.
How do you spell that?
I think it's F-R-A-S-E.
I think P-O-O-P works better. I like to bring in sex to spice up this thing. What's the monarch sex life?
They generally mate on the ground. The male clings to the female, and it can look like one butterfly with their wings moving in unison. And in the winter, they go into reproductive diapause, so once the temperature warms, they'll mate either right before they leave Mexico or on their way north again, and so when the females arrive, they're ready to put their eggs on the milkweed plants.
I'd always thought that the northbound would regenerate, have another generation in Texas or whatever, but apparently that isn't true. They fly 1,500 miles before that occurrence.
Yeah, it's really weather dependent, but it's to save energy that they go into reproductive diapause so that they're not, you know, active and looking for love in the winter.
What diseases are affecting the life and the quality of the environment for the monarch?
Just to go back to how you spell butterfly poop, it's F-R-A-S-S or frass. there's a parasite called OE that can cause the caterpillars not to be able to metamorphose into healthy butterflies. And that's the real problem with tropical milkweed. And when the monarchs don't migrate, they're all hanging out in the same place. And so they get a higher parasite load. And those OE parasites prevent them from becoming healthy butterflies. And those build up on the milkweed plants. So the native milkweeds generally die back in the winter. That's going to knock off the parasites. But the tropical milkweed, which stays green year-round, just gets higher and higher parasite loads. And then there's pesticides. There's all kinds of pesticides that are toxic to different life stages of the monarch, or that target and kill milkweed, which is one of the primary factors that drove the decline, were crops that had been genetically engineered to be resistant to glyphosate or Roundup spraying, so that Roundup could be applied more often and in higher quantities, and that wiped out the milkweed in the agricultural fields that had traditionally supported most of the Midwestern monarch population.
I will be putting some milkweed plants in soon, but they tend to spread, don't they?
Oh, they definitely do. And they smell amazing. That if you don't want them to spread, like the common milkweed spreads really well. It also smells the best, I think. But the swamp milkweed or pink milkweed doesn't spread as much, and the butterfly milkweed doesn't spread either. So the orange butterfly milkweed is a good one because it doesn't grow as aggressively as the common milkweed.
So the property I've got abuts a river and would... And I'd like to have these plants as close to not so much.
Oh, you should plant swamp milkweed then. It's called Asclepias incarnata.
Asclepias incarnata.
And I'll send that to you. I'll send you a link.
Yeah. And so I've learned two things. I think it's frost or fress.
Uh-huh. I got one more thing for you too, just to circle back to the beginning of our conversation. Insects are animals. They have six legs and they have three body parts.
Good. I was...
Sorry about that.
Jeez, that was a loud monarch.
That was a chocolate Labrador named Riggs, probably protecting me from people walking around the neighborhood.
Oh, goodness. Oh, that's right. We did talk about the fact that the monarch is aggressive, and I think we talked about the fact that the bite of a monarch on a human can cause some respiratory problems.
I can dispel those notions, but I will tell you an insect that is beautiful and can bite are the larvae of dragonflies. They're in the water, and their larvae can pack a wallop on your fingertip.
Wow, my favorite insects are the dragonfly and the praying mantis and the walking stick.
Yeah, they're so cool.
Yeah, I know the praying mantis, and you got to handle it carefully. Okay, so to wrap up, is there just anything that is important that we might have skipped? For example, your action plans going forward with just the monarch, the general population of people that might be listening to this discussion, what are the specific things? Like you say, let's plant more milkweed.
Yes, so monarchs are so threatened, and it's such a sad story, but it's also a way that everyone can get involved in helping out wildlife, because the adults do nectar on hundreds of different flowers. So just by providing flowers that bloom across seasons in your yard, and even common ones that are easy to grow, like echinacea, zinnias, cosmos, sunflowers, they love all of those flowers. And they also, butterflies like to have a little patch of bare dirt, and not using pesticides can help the monarchs. But also, a lot of the habitat decline in Mexico is driven by avocados and avocado farming, because they've become so lucrative. So by eating fewer avocados until the illegal deforestation down there is curtailed will help. And choosing organic corn and soy products will also help, because so many herbicides and pesticides are sprayed in the Midwest that are harmful to monarchs. And the Midwest is the most important part of the country for the monarchs. And so Choosing organic corn and soy will also help the monarchs.
Listeners, this is a time for an action plan. I'd like all of you to raise your hands and promise to eat 2 fewer avocados than you thought otherwise. Get your hands up. Thank you.
So Americans didn't even eat avocados before the mid-1990s, like before the North American Free Trade Agreement. We did not import avocados. There were only domestic avocados. And now we eat billions of avocados every year. And they've become so lucrative that they're driving violence against communities and landholders in Mexico. And bad actors are literally burning down the Monarch Butterfly Biosphere Reserve to illegally clear land to grow more avocados to export to the United States. So it is a dire situation right now. There are forest fires in the Monarch Reserve this winter on an unprecedented scale. And the problem with that is that the habitat conditions the monarch needs in those high elevation forests are so specific that when you clear them and put it in a different kind of tree, it lowers the water table, it breaks the hydrologic regime, it introduces pesticides into their winter habitat. Now the fires are so big this winter, they're dumping chemicals to try to curtail the fires, and all of this is driven by the surge in avocado consumption in the United States.
I occasionally will have questions from listeners who know what the future conversations are going to be. I remember one question, and the question was something like, how does the monarch know what direction to fly, and is it something with the antenna? I don't remember exactly what the question is.
Yeah, so that's a great question. They follow light cues and also the spots on their wings. Apparently the monarchs with larger white spots have greater flight success than the other monarchs, and scientists are still cluing that out. But one of the things that I love is we still don't know how the fourth or fifth generation monarchs wake up in Canada in late summer and say, I gotta go to Mexico. And they go to the small area of forest where their great, 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 great grandparents were. We don't know how they find their way there. And I love that we don't know, and I hope that we never really figure it out.
Well, the monarchs on that flight will occasionally stop wherever they can for feeding.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But generally, is there a flight altitude that's common?
It depends on the weather. They can fly super high, or you can see them flying right above the tree line. I was in Florida last week, and I saw monarchs at the top of some pine trees down there, and I knew that they were the migratory monarchs and not the local monarchs just because of the way that they were clustering together in the top of the trees. So it really depends on the weather.
That reminds me, soon after we moved up here, like 5 years ago, I was looking into things about the ducks. And there's a story about a duck found at a high altitude observed by a commercial airline pilot over the state of Nevada. And the altitude for that duck was 38,000 feet.
Wow.
Yeah, apparently they have a certain lung that will put up with that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and there's birds like godwits that fly from the northern to the southern hemisphere nonstop. They fly so far, like the red knot on the east coast is another bird that just flies these super long flights. And when they get back to the coast up north, they are literally on the very brink of starvation. They've flown so far that they're digesting their own muscles, and so they have to stop and rest and feed, or that's it. They're not going to make it on up to the Arctic where they're headed because they've had such a long nonstop flight. And one of the problems now with the red knot is they only eat horseshoe crabs. The horseshoe crab eggs, and humans have over-harvested them so much, and climate change and sea level rise are impacting them, that the red knots don't have enough food. And so now the red knots and the horseshoe crabs are both threatened species. And that one breaks my heart. It just breaks my heart that a bird can fly for days and get to where its ancestors have always found food and get there and just die of starvation because we've literally stolen its food.
Well, both of us now have a broken heart.
Oh.
Thanks, Tara.
Happy birthday.
Yes, listeners, today's my birthday. I'm almost a century old. You indicated you are willing to come back on for another conversation. And I think further that perhaps the coal mining in Appalachia would be a good next conversation.
Yeah, Appalachia. I'll throw an Appalachia.
Good. You'll toss an Appalachia. I'll remember that. But anyway, that would be a good conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suppose it's one that you will probably break my heart again.
Things are better than they were a few decades ago.
Well, good. We'll stress that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. This has been a fun and wonderful and interesting and informative and all of those things. And I'm so glad I learned about Fress.
I'll actually send you some pictures.
Oh, okay, listeners, you know what to do when we get to the show notes.
Listen, have a wonderful birthday dinner and a wonderful anniversary.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
and,
talk soon.
And I wish you well. Okay, bye.
Thank
now.
Thank you. Bye.
I have several guests lined up through the fall. The next two guests, one will be a philosopher discussing the philosophy of beauty. And following that will be an individual who's an assistant general manager at a convention center discussing sustainability and environmental impact on their work. And please do be generous with a contribution to the Center for Biological Diversity, for which Tiara Curry works. And I hope that you will also consider making a donation to support the show, found on the show notes.